are back. You're listening to You Would Think, the Philadelphia Flyers podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Collington. Joining me today, Mr. Mike Giletto. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Hope everyone's doing well and everyone's over being sick and back to work and doing good things in 2020.
Absolutely. It's good to have you. And also, Mr. Kevin Durso. How you doing, buddy?
Doing really well.
All right. I don't necessarily know if you're a fan favorite, but you're my favorite. Don't tell Mike Senior.
I love having him on. It's always really good conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to get to some of that good conversation here in a second. But before we do that, you can find the show on Twitter at YWT Podcast. You can find Mike at Mike from S Jersey. Producer Mike at Mike _ Giletto. Kevin at Kevin _ Durso. And then he's also kind of at Flyerdelphia and Sports Talk PHL. He's all over the place. He's everywhere. You know, we'll get into that. But you know what? How you guys doing? This Flyers team is in a much better spot than it was last week, I would say.
Yeah, I'm in a better mood this week than I was last week.
Oh, thank God, because that was miserable to deal with, honestly. It's good. I think we're going to have a little more of a fun conversation today. Last week was pretty doom and gloom. We ended up talking about the All-Star game for a very long time. Kevin, any snubs, by the way, that you think of from the All-Star game?
I mean, not from the Flyers. I can
know,
tell
I just
you
put
that
you
much.
On the spot here a little
no,
bit.
No, not from the Flyers. I mean, I did agree. I saw a couple of people with the last man in thing yesterday when it was announced. A couple of people saying Brock Nelson should have gotten in from the Islanders. I kind of agree with that.
I think he's
had a good year. I don't really know of too many yet, to be honest. I thought that they nailed the West in terms of the last man in. Like, David Perron absolutely should have been there. No question about it.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
I think that they pretty much nailed it. I guess it was the Metro Division had a lot of interesting candidates out of that. I don't know that Oshie was necessarily the top guy to pick. That's why I said, like, Nelson was a good, I thought was a good choice. And I think that there was also an argument, I'm trying to remember who Pittsburgh's one was. I think it was Letang Pittsburgh's option for the last man in, because I thought he might have earned one as well. You know, they've just been so solid with all the injuries they've had, and he's a big part of that. Letang is definitely a big part of that.
Yeah, and just real quick, do you like the All-Star game, or is it just kind of a couple days off for you?
You know, I was listening to what you guys were talking about last week, and I really liked the idea that bring the two ideas together in terms of the 3-on-3 thing is great, because I do think it breeds competition more than it did from the traditional game. But I do. I also liked your idea about the draft again. I like the draft, but do the 3-on-3 format too.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Why not both ways? Just playground style.
Well, I think it's fun. The draft part of it was fun because, I mean, you had players kind of ribbing on players at that event. You know, I mean, there was that year that Phil Kessel went last, and everybody kind of knew it was coming. So whoever picked him was like, yeah, I guess we'll take Phil then.
That was funny.
But it breeds that kind of thing. So I think people need to see that. Like, people need to see the way players interact. But the 3-on-3 thing actually does make it competitive.
Because the NHL really does an awful job at promoting their superstars, and this is the one time where you get to see people have a little personality.
Well, there's also, I mean, there's really also not much motivation for guys to be there. I mean,
no,
they don't. It's not an event. I mean, I remember when it used to be much more of an event when it was, you know, I'm seeing clips of a couple things like that. I think they went back to
Senior remembers. You can just talk about it. It probably happened when Senior was.
But there was a clip from, I don't remember what year it was. I don't know if it was specified in the tweet what year it was, but it was when. And Owen Nolan had a hat trick in the game in San Jose. It might have been 97 or something like that. And I remember those uniforms because it was the East wore like a teal green and the West wore a purple or something like that. And they kind of used to look like the Dallas Stars old jerseys in the 90s that had the star design at the bottom. Like, but that was when I think the game, like, that was when you actually put together a real roster from both lineups. I don't even know if I remember at that time if they had to include one player from every single team like they do now.
Right, and there were also just a couple less teams. I think at that point there were 28, maybe even less
probably,
at that point.
It might have been less at that point. I think it might have been 26 at that point, to be honest. And
right, but going back to the draft, I do like the concept of the 3-on-3 teams, and you just kind of pick schoolyard style. Because my favorite fantasy draft all-star game memory was Ovi begging to go last because whoever got picked last won a car. And he wanted the car, so he kept talking about, no, pick me last, I need the car. And they're looking at him like, Alex, you've made like $80 million in your career.
Yeah,
he's
right?
Like, no, I want car. And he ended up not getting picked last, and he was furious about it. There were a couple trades. You know, they had a lot of fun with it. And the guys got to show a little personality, and I enjoyed that. That's kind of what I would go to if I was in charge.
I think the word, the best word to use there is it adds interest. Anything that can add interest to the game and or the event itself, which no one had any interest when it was this 5-on-5, you know, 16-15 final scores with no defense whatsoever. There was no interest in the game. Mm-hmm. The 3-on-3 creates interest, and the draft would also create additional interest just because it makes it more fun to watch.
Yeah, and you still do it how you do it, where you have the four teams and you have a little mini tournament. Like, that all works exactly the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it also allows you to get a little more creative and let captains design the uniforms or something that's not just, well, here's the Metro, here's the Atlantic, here's, you know, blah, blah, blah. By the way, also, they released the All-Star jerseys this week. I don't know if you gentlemen saw them, but they're not good.
Okay, I do want to comment on this because I did not realize what... at first glance, and here's the thing, too, being someone who has a history as a musician and things like that, like, I totally didn't see it to begin with. I didn't realize what the stripes were for at all.
They're music notes because it's in St. Louis.
It's a musical staff, and I had no idea that's what it is. And at first glance, like, I'm looking at it, I'm going, okay, there's just stripes across the middle of the jersey. This doesn't make any sense. And here's the thing. It makes sense with the Blues logo.
When you realize it's
because
St. Louis.
Because the Blues logo fits into it like a musical note would. Put these other logos on it. Like, I don't remember seeing the Blues logo as the first one on the picture.
It wasn't the lead image.
Like, I was seeing Carolina, and I was seeing maybe Boston, or maybe, you know, another team like that. And you're seeing just this standard logo that's probably either a circular design or something like that, and you're going, okay, what's the deal with the stripes, though? Like, it looks like you're just putting stripes through a logo.
I think the first one I saw was, like, the Ducks.
That might be, yeah. I mean, it could be something like that. And again, I just didn't see what the purpose of it was. And then, like, I saw a comment on it that was, like, that moment when you realize that that's what it is.
That it's musical notes.
And I'm going, I never even put it together.
Yeah, I really dislike the white one kind of across the board. Some of the black ones look really good. But overall, I think it's a poor design.
I didn't think the white ones look good at all.
No, I
agree.
The black
ones look better.
Right, that's exactly what I mean. Like, the white ones look pretty bad across the board. The black one, there's definitely some really good ones in there. Did I say it the other way around? I'm sorry.
The white's awful.
The white's not good.
Decent. The one thing I will compliment in the style of jersey is they did do in a unique way... a good way to uniform all of the jerseys while individualizing the player with his logo.
Yeah,
look uniform, and you can still tell what team that particular player is from and who he's representing which team. So I think that was a good thing, but the white is awful.
Yeah, I think it's better than the uniforms from a couple years ago, the black with like the weird peach color, if you remember what I'm talking about. The jerseys where they all have the NHL logo on the front is terrible, in my opinion. Right. And they have, like, their little logo on the shoulder, and you can barely tell, and you're, like, squinting and trying to figure out who it is. So putting the individual team logo on the front, I do think is a good decision. But some of them look pretty terrible, I'm not going to lie.
Do you think also the way it's being shown, looks like it's a very slender cut? Is that just the way they're showing it, or is that the way the jersey's actually cut? Does anybody know?
I think it's probably just the picture.
Let's hope so.
Yeah,
I think it's just going to be a standard jersey, honestly. But the All-Star Game is in a couple weeks. Last Man In, I believe, closed last night. Have they announced that yet?
They announced it before the game, before the 7 o'clock games last night. So it was Oshie for the Metro. Perron was the last one in for the, I guess it was the Central. I have to go and look at the other two.
Did Larkin make it out of the Atlantic? Because that was the other big story around this vote, was that he didn't want it. So did he end up getting it and he has to go or skip it?
I don't think he did.
Okay.
I'm sure he's relieved. I'm checking the four now. Mitch Marner made it from the Atlantic. Quinn Hughes made it from the Pacific.
Yeah, it was... Even if Dylan Larkin wanted it, he's got an uphill ride against any Toronto player, but especially a guy like Marner, for sure. But All right, well, that'll do
again,
it for
I'll say it again. Anybody who doesn't want to go, other than somebody like Ovi, that's put his career and time in, that's all. That says all you need to know about that player and why that team stinks.
No, I don't give players a hard time for wanting an extra couple days off, but I understand. Moving on, we're not going to get into that again.
No, I understand.
The Flyers had a better week, but you know it's kind of hard to have a worse week than they had last week. So you beat Washington on Wednesday night. That felt to me like the team proving that they belong, or attempting to prove that they belong. You know, it's Wednesday night. It's you know, the best team in the league at the time, you know, in the national game. And you kind of just outplayed them.
Maybe without reason going into that game, I completely expected them to play well.
Yeah, because they always play to the level of their competition. And, you know, during the week as a whole, Tuesday night you lost in Carolina in overtime. We'll talk about that game. Wednesday night you beat Washington at home. And then Saturday night you lose to Tampa in another game where I think you played well the whole time. But to me, the crown jewel of the week was Washington. You know, you beat that
Absolutely.
Team. And you really proved that you might not be the best team in the league. You might not blah, blah, blah. But you have certainly earned your position in a wild card spot. You've earned the right to call yourself a playoff contender. Is that fair to say?
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that as well.
Like, anytime you play one of the best teams in the league and you can go toe-to-toe, you show what you can do. Of course, in hindsight, it makes the road trip that much more frustrating and that much more irritating. But at least there's hope that this team's not ready to fall off a cliff.
Right, and we, one of the big stories going into Saturday night's game in Tampa, in Philadelphia against Tampa, is that Tampa's the hottest team in the league. You know, they go into that game having won 9 straight, taking on all comers. They look like last year's President's Trophy winners. They're really kind of starting to roll. Kucherov's racking up points. They're really starting to come around.
They're so fast. But God, I'm sorry.
And the matchup is that team, against the Flyers, who at home are the best team in hockey. Kevin, you've picked a pretty good year to go to every home game. What have you seen from the team at home that you don't see when they're playing on the road?
Structure. I mean, I think that there's so much more defensive zone structure. Their penalty kill is more structured at home, and there's really no explanation for it because those are not things that have to translate home in a way.
Okay. Sure.
The only thing that you can say about both of those things is if you're starting with a defensive zone draw and you can't do the matchups because you don't have last change, that's about the only excuse you have on the road as opposed to home. But I don't see any reason why on the penalty kill they don't play the same way on the road that they do at home or vice versa. You know, where the structure came from against two of the best power play teams in the league after looking horrible on a road trip for 6 games against teams that didn't have the best power plays. I mean, what was it? The LA, they played in LA, and LA had the 2 worst special teams units, essentially, and they give up 2 power play goals and a shorthanded goal to that team, but they didn't give up anything to Washington.
What were they, 5 for 5 against Washington?
5 for 5 against Washington.
That's crazy.
They're 4 for 4 against Tampa Bay, and one of them was a 4-minute
kill. That 40-minute kill was fantastic.
It was fantastic.
They weren't even set up in the zone until there was only a minute left. The first 3 minutes, they never got zone time on that power play. It was amazing. The kill was fantastic.
The Flyers might have had more scoring chances on that than Tampa did. Like, it's wild. And again, Wednesday night, we're talking about the penalty kill. Kevin Hayes scores the shorthanded game winner deep in the second on, you know, a pretty important kill. Getting a kill there is a big deal. You don't expect to score a goal.
Right. If you don't go minus one there, you're plus. You're not
scoring
only don't go minus, you go plus one. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Scoring a goal in that game, in a tie game, deep in the second, on the penalty kill, was an enormous goal.
And especially when they don't lose when ahead after 2.
Exactly. And then locked it down in the third.
Well, and I liken that goal by Hayes in that situation to the one he scored against Columbus because that was a third period goal. But I liken it to that because Sean Couturier took a penalty there that he didn't think he deserved. Not that it wasn't a penalty, but he thought he had drawn a penalty 10 seconds earlier.
It's a tough call given how the game was called. Yeah,
and in that situation, maybe my mind drifts to the last 3-4 years where you go, this is the spot where they give one up because
here we go.
Because
there's
frustration. You lose your head a little bit. The snowball effect comes into play. And instead, the way it was in the Columbus game earlier in the year in October, it's here comes the penalty. They've worked this whole period to get the game tied up. Now they've got to go back and kill a penalty with 6 minutes left in the game. And this is the spot where Columbus gets that extra goal and makes the whole comeback, null and void.
Right.
The same thing with this Washington game where you look at it and you go, here comes the goal that's going to possibly change the game. Okay, get ready for the shot from Ovechkin at the circle,
Well, they certainly got a goal that changed the game.
Oh, yeah. Well, and here's the thing. They've played Washington twice this year, and in both cases, I don't remember Ovechkin getting that look. They're the one team that seems to be able to, seems to be able to take away that play. More than any other.
Especially the one-timer. He's had a few shots off, but not really that one-timer. I remember
from Wednesday's game specifically, Ovechkin had two shots during power play time. One was just a wrist shot because he couldn't control the pass cleanly. So he had to stop, gain control, and then shoot. And by that point, Carter Hart was over to make the save anyway. And he got one-timer in the third period, I think. And Hart came over and swallowed
that up. He was just completely squared up on it.
And no rebound. And it was, at that situation, it was perfect. Perfect execution by Hart on that particular chance. And there you go. That's sometimes all you need to make the difference.
Yeah, and a lot of that strategy that you employ against the Washington Capitals translates over to the Tampa Bay Lightning because they kind of try to do the same thing. With Stamkos on one side and Kucherov on the other, and all they're looking for is that one-timer. That's their whole power play, basically.
Yeah, and Tampa Bay, the thing about Tampa Bay is that they have it coming from both sides.
They have it on both sides,
It's much more unique that way. I think that Washington's two options usually turn out to be Ovechkin at the left circle, and if not him, then Carlson at the top. Exactly. Which the Flyers were
guilty of for a long time with Ghost at the top and Giroux at the circle.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it is kind of that way. But what I noticed about the penalty kill on both of those games for teams that are really aggressive and try to get that perfect set play and are able to, let's not shade it for what it is. They're able to execute those plays very well. It's not the same.
Right, they do it for a reason.
It's not the Flyers looking for that play where they don't really have that guy who's locked and loaded and is money from that spot. Everybody knows what Ovechkin's looking for, and everybody knows Kucherov and Stamkos are good from that spot too.
Right.
So it's not that kind of thing. And what the Flyers would do is, from what I could see from my vantage point, was very aggressive at the blue line. There's not a lot of space
really
on entry.
They mentioned that on the broadcast.
So they would come in, and before you knew it, and Sean Couturier was one of the best at this, especially in that game against Tampa, getting to the puck right away upon entry, so that there was almost immediately a disruption, and that creates the turnover. He was very good at, I think it was funny because Hayes took one of the penalties against Tampa Bay, and Couturier had two against Washington, and they kind of almost helped each other out in terms of being the number one guy on some of those kills.
Yeah,
where you lose a guy in the box for 2 minutes who is definitely a key part of your penalty kill, and it turns out to be the other guy stepping up and finding a way to make the clear in that spot or get the turnover that leads to a scoring chance or something, anything like that.
Yeah,
The best way to stop that pass across for the one timer against both power plays is to stop the setup. If you can stop the setup, you have a much better chance of stopping the pass across.
Yeah,
I think Washington's game is their power play is much more predicated on power. Where I think Tampa Bay, while they both can bring the similar, drives from those same areas, it's a little more predicated on speed and finesse. But still, both fantastic power plays.
Yeah, for sure.
Tampa Bay has options all over the place, too. It's not just the Stamkos and Kucherov one-timer setup. They went below the goal line a couple of times, I remember, and were kind of looking out front. And, Killorn was playing net front on that first unit, I believe, and Hedman's out at the top, and Braden Point's all over the place. Braden Point kind of hovers between – he's actually, I think, just all over the place, quite honestly. Sometimes he's out toward the top. Sometimes he's in the high slot. Sometimes he's the one below the goal line.
Seems to have a great ability to dart in and out, where Bergeron's a little more just kind of sit in that slot and wait, and he's great at it. But Point seems to get you know, come in and get out, come in and get out. And it's more of a flow and watch finding the spot and when to jump in. And I think that's even harder to cover.
He creates problems.
Point's one of my favorite young players to watch in a game right now, just because his speed is so good anyway. And quite honestly, I'd argue that he was the fastest player on the ice last night, because Yanni Gourde was flying last night.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look at Point's game, and he's got such all around skill that it's insane how good he is, and he's gonna be a superstar in the league.
Yeah,
whoever scouts for them is just amazing.
Steve Yzerman did a phenomenal job drafting as long as he was there. Braden Point is a fantastic player. He's not quite as flashy as some of your super duper stars, right? He's not a Connor McDavid. He's not a Mikko Rantanen with, you know, all flash and fanciness, but he is in the right spot, makes the right plays with the puck, and just scores goals and just finishes. He's a really, really solid player. But I noticed, you know, going back to the penalty kill here, in the last two games, Washington, where you killed off five, and Tampa Bay, where you killed off four, I'm not sure if at any point in any of those nine power plays, the other team got a clean zone entry and then set it up immediately.
In the last two, I don't believe so.
In the last two games, I don't think that happened a single time. I think every single time a pass was broken up or somebody made a good play, got a good stick out. Michael Raffo had a really good game against Tampa. Tyler Pitlick did some great work penalty killing against Tampa.
He was excellent in that game against Tampa.
The whole conversation in there kind of started with, you know, how well they're doing the kill at home. And the reasons for why they're doing it so well at home is not so much on the road, like the Kings game, like Kevin mentioned. And I think Kevin's 100% right in structure and discipline and what they're doing. But I think that still somewhat begs the question, why? Why aren't they bringing that structure on the road? And I think a small part of it, maybe even a larger part of it, I think youth has a lot to do with it. For some reason, I think when you're home and you're young, you seem to be more focused in front of your home fans, more intense in front
of
your home fans.
It's easy to play confident hockey in front of your home fans.
Or at least more intense hockey, because you're in front of your guys. Nobody ever wants to look bad ever, but we're human. And when you have that little bit of extra juice of being in front of your home fans, sometimes you have a little extra pep in your step, and they got to figure out a way to bring that to the road as well, and I'm sure Elaine will get them there.
Yeah, and the NHL is so tight, and there's so much parity that little bit can be enough from, you know, being the best team in the league at home and being medium to bad on the road. And that's
if they're going to get to a three seed, which is huge different from being the 7 or 8 seed. Huge
Absolutely.
Difference, which we talked about. If they have, 17, 18 road games left, something like that?
Something along half of half.
Yeah, so probably.
If they don't figure out a way to win 10 of those games at a minimum, you can flush the three seed. It's impossible. They have to figure out how to go three or four games over 500 on the road the rest of the year, and then maintain what they're doing at home. Then they have a shot.
I agree. And, you know, one of the old adages is, you know, you want to go 500 on the road and win most of the games in your building.
But it's too late for that.
Right, exactly. So now to get to that 500 point on the season, they have to go pretty significantly above 500 the rest of the way here.
Yeah.
And their home record has been sparkling enough that you can get away with some things on the road.
Yeah.
But you can't get away with being as bad as they've been.
If they could pull a 9-6-2 over the last, you know, then they got a shot for that three seed. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, right. No shot.
And by the way, just a little playoff update, because I do kind of want to touch on this on a weekly basis. Flyers are right now in the second wild card spot. Columbus is tied with them. Florida's 1 point back. Those are kind of the only teams that are still kind of in the conversation right now. You know, New York's down there, the Buffalo's down there. But, you know, the dangerous teams are Columbus with 52 points, Florida with 51. Flyers also have 52. Carolina's in the first wild card spot, and they're 4 points up on us. So right now, you know, you're pretty comfortable in that second spot, but you obviously want to start climbing up.
As long as they maintain their home dominance, I think a playoff spot is almost – you know, not assured,
but it's really, really,
unless they go 10-10 at home the rest of the way, then that's a problem too.
Right.
But assuming they continue to play as well as they have at home or close to it, I think they'll make the playoffs.
Right. Now, that brings me to this. Four of the next five are at home. But in those games, you play Boston, Montreal, Los Angeles, and Pittsburgh. Now, Boston is obviously a very, very good team. Pittsburgh next Tuesday. Obviously, you have Pittsburgh. You know, that is what it is. Next week's show, we're going to talk a lot about that Pittsburgh game because it's time. But this week, you know, you got Boston, Montreal, and L.A. You know, Montreal's kind of out of things. Same with L.A. Boston's one of the best teams in the league. And, oh, by the way, your one road game is in St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Defending Stanley Cup champions.
Right.
So the next week or so is not necessarily going to be easy, but it's a big points week for the Flyers. You have four games. If you can pick up 6 points, I think you're really happy with this week. Does that make sense?
6 out of 8, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Here's what I'll say about the whole thing, kind of, and this might be a little bit of a long-winded answer, so I apologize.
No way.
Well, here's the thing. I want to, because when I look at road trips like that, and I watch the way that Twitter gets sometimes, I'm all about perspective.
And you heard it on this show a little bit last week. There was a little doom and gloom.
No, but a little bit, but not. You guys were fairly on par with it. I see a lot of ridiculous things on Twitter. Just in general, like people overreact. People overreact to things, and that's why my first thing of perspective about the 6-game road trip was it is a 6-game stretch. That is 7% of your season. It does not define a season completely. Now, granted, the road struggles are a problem collectively, and it takes away from you can kind of throw away that 1 week that everybody wanted to dismiss as the Oscar Lindblom news and. That affects the way the team plays. You kind of have to dismiss that after a road trip like that where you go, well, you're beyond that now. You came home and played really well. Why didn't it carry over to the road?
Right.
But I also look at a team that went on the road 8 times in the month of November and actually won more games on the road than they did at home. You know, their November was great. They actually won 4 times at home and 6 on the road. And they just didn't lose in regulation at home. That was the difference. They lost 4 times at home, all of them were shootout losses.
Because they still have points in, 19 of 22 games at home? Something along those lines?
Loss to Tampa was their third regulation loss on home ice the entire year. And just like the first, I don't even say like the first two, I'll say like the last one against Arizona, not a bad game performance-wise, it's just... You're playing against a team that really knows. And you know what? A lot of people were talking about it last night in post-game where it was, hey, you know, this is not the style Tampa Bay played last year. Tampa Bay was wide open games. You were playing 6-5 games. There was one goal between the two teams in the first meeting of the year.
I don't think anybody expected that to be a 1-0 game last night.
No, not at all.
And Jim Jackson mentioned it on the broadcast. Like, oh, this isn't exactly the game we thought we were going to have here tonight.
Right.
All right. I don't think Vasilevskiy's given up a goal since 2019.
I don't think he's given up a goal.
It's pretty close. I mean, he's gone 2 straight games with shutouts now.
Right.
So back to this week, Tampa's scary again, by the way. Yeah, Tampa is.
Continuing.
Tampa's getting really good. So back to this week and kind of keeping things in perspective here. I've said this to you guys before when we've done the show. I hate the term must win in the middle of a season. But I absolutely think that the games against Montreal and Los Angeles are kind of must-win games this week.
Yeah.
When you look at the other teams. I mean, it's really just unfortunate the way the schedule plays out because, you know, you just played Washington, who was, at the time, the best team in the league points-wise.
By the time we play Boston, they're going to be in that spot.
Boston is already tied for that. And guess what? St. Louis is tied, too. They're all at 65 points.
Great. So we can play the best team in the league 3 times in a week, and they're 3 different teams.
Right. Yeah. And Tampa Bay was the hottest team coming in. So, you know, and Tampa Bay was, by the time they actually played here anyway, was tied for 6th in the league in points. So it really didn't make a difference. Like, that's still a top 10 team. Everybody knew it. You know, and Pittsburgh is going to be another one. Pittsburgh's another team that's top 5 in the league in points. You know?
Yeah.
So you get Montreal, who's kind of hit or miss on most nights. And, you know, the fact that it's a home game should play into your favor. And I'd say the same thing with the Kings. You know, okay, the first game in LA was not very good at all, understandably so, but it's a home game. And home games seem to be different for this team. And against teams like that, you should be able to find a way. And those are the two. So if we're talking about getting 6 points out of 8 in a given week, and I think it's a fair request at this stage of the season, you need to start moving the line again.
You need to start accruing points, right?
Right.
Now, if you don't get those 4, it's going to be hard to get 6.
Well, exactly.
Very much so. And I would agree. These are about as close as you can get to a must-win regular season game. Because if you do lose one, even if you go 1-1 in the other two games against those two great teams, that 1-1 is fantastic. So if you win those two must-win games, now you're 3-1. If you're fortunate enough to win those two games, by some stretch of the imagination, you do that, well, you can't now give that back playing losing one of those two games.
Yep.
And you know what I mean? So either way, they're must wins.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, when the Flyers play Montreal on Thursday night in Philadelphia, Montreal will also be on the second night of a back-to-back. So Wednesday night, the Flyers...
I think we are too, though.
Wednesday night, the Flyers play in St. Louis and then fly home to play Thursday night against the Canadiens. The Canadiens are at home playing the Blackhawks Wednesday night, and then they fly to Philly to play the Flyers on Thursday night. Right.
Mm-hmm.
From a Flyers fan perspective, thinking about the goaltending situation in Montreal, like there's a chance that Carey Price just plays both because he does that sometimes. But I kind of doubt it. I imagine they probably give him the home start against Chicago on Wednesday night, and then the Flyers get whoever their backup is, Kincaid or whoever's over there today. So you might be able to just get a backup out of there too and just – kind of lock up those 2 points. Obviously, you got to play it out, but I'd prefer to see their backup Thursday night. I don't know about you guys.
Well, I'd always prefer to not see Price, of course, but you know, you got to play the game.
Right.
Well, let's put it this way. It didn't matter. Both goalies got to start against the Flyers already this year, and both games went to overtime. So, yes, you've got to play them out.
You know? Well, yeah. But the fact that they're on the second half of a back-to-back, you know.
Yeah.
It is nice because it always frustrates me when the Flyers play a back-to-back where they're on the road the first night. It just irritates me for some reason because it's like the whole point of home field or home ice is that you get to like sleep in your own bed and go through your normal like game day routine. And that's just not the case because you're flying in from St. Louis the night before.
Right. Less irritating when the other team is also traveling and played the night
before.
That's why
I looked it up.
Well, you're also saying it from a perspective, too, where this is not like a trip to New Jersey or something like that. It's St. Louis, so it's a legit flight.
Trip, yeah.
You know, they've played back-to-backs where New Jersey was the first team in the back-to-back, and it was on the road, and you go, okay, so you're just, you know, taking the train up to, you know,
right.
to Newark and coming back the same night, and it's not a big deal.
Right,
it's like
you
a Pee Wee hockey trip.
Right.
You played New Jersey one night, you play Washington the next. Oh, no.
Right, and it could be any of those. You know, you could have played in Washington and then had to come home.
Right.
Or played the Rangers or something like that. Like, it's not as long of a trip.
No, St. Louis is a trip,
though.
This
is St. Louis. That's a trip, yeah.
It's a couple hours. It's a different time zone. I know it doesn't have too much to do with it, but an hour makes a difference.
Sure.
But either way, I definitely think this is a good barometer week, and I know we've talked about that a lot. And a lot of weeks have been barometer weeks. But right now, you get a chance to prove that you can play with some of the best teams in the league, right? You just played Washington. You just played Tampa. You're 1-1 in those games, and you were in both of them. If you're competitive against Boston and St. Louis, that to me, if you look good against Boston and St. Louis, even if you don't lose, even if you don't win both of them, if you look good in those games, to me, that acquits a lot of the bad road trip.
I just don't see anything that they've done so far this year in the games against Boston, Tampa Bay, Washington. You know, every team that they've played that's been good, they've played well.
Yeah.
I mean, I know they shit the bed against Pittsburgh earlier in the year, but Pittsburgh wasn't that good then. So I really don't – that was just them, you know, just not showing up for a game. When they've played good teams, they've played well, so – I fully expect they'll play well again. And what's made this another barometer week is the fact that they played so bad on the road. So now you need another barometer week. They shouldn't need another barometer week, but unfortunately they do.
Right. And again, we're still in the point of the season where we're trying to accrue points and trying to get ourselves in a good playoff spot and trying to avoid having to play a team like Boston or Washington in the first round. You know, it's as simple as that.
And trying to avoid the scramble in the last week to two weeks of the season of trying to accumulate points because, you know, you're just in playoff position. You want to try to bag some points, so you're trying to get to three, not trying to solidify seven or eight.
Well, listen, the way this team has played on the road versus at home, three is not good enough, man. If you're shooting for a division spot, you want to try to shoot for two, right? So you have home ice.
That goes along your, you know, they can get to the Eastern Conference Finals thing, which I never bought into.
I understand.
I'll take a 3 seed, no problem.
But at the same time, what you just said comes into effect. The fact that they've played well against Washington, they've played well against Tampa, they've played well against teams like Boston, that's the kind of thing that makes me think they can get there. Because once you're in the playoffs, you don't have to worry about playing Anaheim and then Los Angeles. You're only playing good teams, and your intensity level is up. And I think this team is getting to the point where they have enough talent to skate with those teams over a bit of a longer series.
If they go 7 or 8 and they do play Washington or Boston in the first round, I will in no way, shape, or form expect them to win that series. However, it should look discernibly different than the last two playoff appearances where they literally had no shot and were dominated for 45, 50 minutes out of 60 in those games, even some of the games they won.
I'm willing to agree with that. And just to
jog our much more competitive series.
And just to jog our listeners' memories, that was the Penguins in 2018 and then the Capitals in 2016, both of which were first round exits.
Yeah, we lost Washington in 5 and it wasn't that close to Pittsburgh, I think, in 6.
The only reason,
you know what? They might have both gone 6, but anyway, the games weren't that close.
The Washington one did go 6, and the problem with the Washington series was as soon as you lost the first game and lost Jean Couturier for the series, it was game over, series over, pretty much almost immediately.
And then you lost Elliott after game 3. Or no, he got pulled. I believe he got pulled.
That might be the Pittsburgh series you're thinking of, because when they played Washington all those years ago, Washington was still Steve Mason.
It was still Steve Mason, right?
And yeah, Steve Mason and Michael Neuvirth were the two goalies. And Neuvirth came in after game 3 and that, I think got it. Them 2 wins.
He actually stole a game, yeah.
He stole one game and actually nearly stole game 6, too, because it was only a 1-0 final, and that's a team that ended up, I think, actually that year. I think Washington ended up losing in the second round again. That was before the cup year. You know, so that was one thing. The year they played Pittsburgh was a different story.
Yeah, I think that team was just kind of outmatched.
They were, but I mean, and at the same time, you know, a lot of important guys getting hurt in the series again. The goaltending thing was still a big issue. That I think is the first thing that everybody would want to see, and it's hard to determine how it's going to go because you have to ride the ups and downs of a 21-year-old goaltender, but it is a goaltender who probably has more ability, even at that age, than, you know, at least trying to, in terms of, I think, sound fundamentals. That doesn't go away. Like, you don't forget the fundamentals. They might not be on every single game, and that's the difference between home and road with Carter Hart a little bit, is that the fundamentals look a little off when he's on the road, and that can be anything. It can be mentality, it can be routine, it can be whatever. He can tell us nothing really changes. I think stuff does change a little bit. Your mindset's a little different on the road, especially as a kid. It has to be. So that's the big thing. But at least that part of it is stable. I feel like every time the Flyers went to a playoff series in the last 5 years, the 2 times they did, there was no clear-cut number one goalie. It was, let's see who we're riding, who's hot right now. And it might be Brian Elliott, or it might be Michael Neuvirth, or it might be Steve Mason, or it might be, you know, insert name here. And
keep your fingers crossed.
Right, and then you have to hope that the guy, A, is healthy enough to do it, and B, has enough of the fundamentals to get it done. You know, and I to go back on what we were talking about with barometer weeks and things like that, I fully agree with the fact that this is a barometer week. This whole stretch is a barometer as far as I'm concerned, because this, to me, this whole portion of the month of January is going to determine what kind of team this is and where they're heading.
Right.
You know, you kind of painted yourself as this team on the road with that road trip, and everybody kind of did the sky is falling kind of thing with, you know, these 6 games are who they are and whatever.
I'm going to say something after you finish your point.
Well, and here's the thing. That very well may be true, but I think you'd have to see that continue over the course of the entire month against these good teams too, to know that. You know, they play the way they do against Washington, you've got a good team that can be competitive against the best in the league. If you play like you did against the Kings or against the Sharks, you've got a team that is defined as kind of gets beat around, kind of doesn't show up with the energy they need to, slow starts, doesn't, you know, all these different factors come into play. The defensive structure, the goalie doesn't seem to be as good as people think he is. Like all these things come into play when you play that way. If you can play the way they've played against Washington and Tampa Bay, then that can be what defines your team. It can be your identity as a team that plays hard, plays physical, plays with a lot of intensity, and can pull out a few games against the best teams in the league. The perspective part of it that comes into it for me is the fact that, you know, even this particular week, 1-1-1 against those three teams is not bad.
No.
You know, it's not bad at all.
No, Carolina's a good team, too.
The problem that you have with that situation is, you by getting the game to overtime in Carolina, you really needed that second point given the week that you had already had before.
Because they're the team currently sitting in the first wild card spot. You're directly competing with them.
To be quite honest, I think I tweeted it as overtime started, you don't even want that game to go to overtime.
No.
But you had to take it given what you had just done the week before. Yep. You needed points of any kind. So you gladly take the one. You could really use two, and you could have used two in regulation. But given the way everything in that game played out, take the 1 point, try to earn the second one in overtime. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. The game against Washington is as perfect as it gets from a result standpoint. You play well, you get the timely goal, you get the timely saves, you get a win in regulation against a tough divisional team.
Yep.
The Tampa game, while getting no points, the way I look at it, if somebody would have said they would have allowed one goal and it would have been to Patrick Maroon, to a team that's won 9 straight games and scored 9 goals on a team two games earlier, I would have told you were nuts.
On that one goal, Kevin, what was Niskanen thinking? He's been terrific, but what was he thinking? That was just a terrible play.
Here's the thing. It's a play that I personally don't like because I don't understand the point of trying to just, you know, use your hand to swat the puck to the other side.
Please describe it for people that didn't say that.
I have no problem with that as long as you simultaneously body the other guy.
Right.
Just get in front of him, and then you can do whatever you want after that.
And I will say this for Matt Niskanen, to his credit, he took the blame for the goal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even said afterwards, you know, he makes that play 50 times in a season. And in this particular case, he said it got caught in his glove, and that's why he wasn't able to swat it away. And he goes, if the same situation presented itself in the very next game, he'd probably try it, and it'll probably be executed the way it needs to be done. That was the one situation. And then, you know, I don't fault him at all for it, but Carter Hart said he should have made the save, and yeah. I don't fault him for it because
I'm just kidding, that's what I want Hart to say, and I appreciate that. But you still got to make the play on the puck while you have position on the offensive player. Yeah, you just have to. Yep.
And for what it's worth, too, as much as you know, Matt Niskanen's probably only having to talk about that the way he did because
it's a 1-0 game.
Because it's a 1-0 game,
and it's what determines the game. At the stage of the game that where it was at the time, aside from the fact that the second period wasn't very good in terms of possession, they really got dominated in possession in that period. And I actually wondered when the third period started if it had to do with the long change, that every time you had the opportunity to get control of the puck, you were in such a dire need of a change anyway. You had to dump it in, make your change. That gave them possession right back. And then the wave came again. It was kind of like this never-ending vicious cycle of lose possession to get that fresh players on the ice in that particular period.
Yeah, I thought that was much more noticeable against a team that has as much speed as Tampa does.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so, but you don't think that at that moment, 7.5 minutes into the second period, that's the goal that's going to define the game.
Right.
There's time to change this result. You know, so Niskanen was kind of having to wear that one, given the fact that it was the deciding goal. But it's, you know, like I said, it's not my favorite play. I don't understand the players who feel the only times I ever understand swatting it with your hand is when it's kind of shallow into the offensive zone. You're not past the circles at that point. Like, it was pretty far into the zone for him to be trying to do that.
If you're
right up at the top of the blue line, it's barely an entry into the zone, and you want to knock it out of, you know, and just because at that point, what are you trying to do? You're probably just trying to bat it barely out of the zone, so it creates an offside at worst.
Yeah, you're just trying to clear a line.
Even if you turn the puck over, if it clears the zone, they're probably coming in thinking, "Oh, I kept it," and it turns into an offside, and the play is over right there. So that's where there's, I think, less room for error, I guess, and less harm in it. It's much less, you know, there's not as much risk involved to that play there. There was a lot of risk involved there, and Maroon, you know, it's not like Maroon can't score goals. I mean, it's not something that's a threat of his game by any stretch. Like, it's not what he's known for, but it's not like he can't score goals either.
He scored some clutch goals in the playoffs last year.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's got that in his game. So it wasn't like this was, you know, how many times over the course of the road trip did somebody come out and score and it was their first or second goal of the year or something like that? This was his sixth of the year. I mean, it's not, you know, he's a fourth liner. Everybody knows that. And
yeah, and I certainly wouldn't call it a soft goal.
No, I didn't think so either. I almost think
he should have had it, but it was not a soft goal.
Well, and before that question was asked, I almost wanted to ask him if the reaction time plays into that. he really didn't have any time to get set. Like, right. I think you're thinking the defenseman's going to take care of this guy at worst, even if Niskanen doesn't play the puck. You're like what Mike Senior just said. If you're bodying the man, the puck probably rolls harmlessly in on goal. He covers it up, and that's the end of the play also.
Right, right.
So maybe that's what you're thinking. He's going to, you know, I think that Hart's going to take lumps for whatever. He doesn't like giving up goals anyway. And I'm sure that, you know, the one thing I'm sure of with him is, as much as we've talked about the differential between home and away for him, he knows it as much as anybody does, and he's trying to figure it out. It's just a matter of finding a way to get – he's got to find – it's as cliche as it gets in hockey, they say, I got to find a way. He's just got to find a way to be that guy on the road. And I think he, you know, going back to last year, I think last year he had like 9 wins in his rookie year on the road. And he got a lot of those opportunities then as they really started to ride him down the stretch. It's not like he's incapable of playing on the road. He can do it. It's just you've got to build that confidence. I kind of think it's crazy that I remember – the shootout win in New Jersey being like a game that you felt like, how good is it that he just got this win? He really needed a win in general, not just home or away or anything. He just needed a win,
right?
Because they were really playing Elliott a lot at that point because he was going through that little rough patch, and it was such a crucial win for him, and it realistically turned everything around because I think he won 2 games on home ice the following week. There was another win on the road against Boston in a shootout that was huge for him. I mean, he made a ton of huge saves in that game. And for what it's worth, that while there's no knowledge of who's starting against Boston, I would fully expect it to be Carter Hart again.
I agree.
On Monday, I would fully expect that.
Yeah,
but
it's similar of any great or potentially great young player who shows great promise. If he's the player that we're anticipating him to be and he turns out to be that player, he will figure this out.
Yeah, and this is just a blip in the radar. And he did have a bad road trip. And I think the rest of the team also had a pretty bad road trip. I don't think it was all on him. The whole team kind of fell apart.
Oh, first of all, it wasn't just him. Yeah,
right.
It was both goalies, first of all.
Yes.
And their save percentage for the road trip was like 85%. It was like sick bad.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm going somewhere with this. So after that road trip, a lot of people were concerned that this team gets pushed around too much. They might not. Like, I don't know if there was they need more hitting, but like, there was definitely some questions regarding the size and strength of this team, for right or for wrong. Were the Flyers, Kevin, I don't know if you know this, were the Flyers ever in on Justin Williams?
Because, probably not.
Okay, because we heard that he signed a contract with the Carolina Hurricanes for the rest of the year, $700K, you know, blah, blah, blah. Apparently, he was also talking to Boston and Toronto. So I was curious if the Flyers ever made a call, because Justin Williams, to me, seems like the kind of guy that would do the Flyers really well at this stage. He's got a little bit of size, a little bit of experience. He provides a little depth, which I think this team desperately needs a bit of a kick in the pants with. And I was curious if there was any sort of chatter about that.
Not to my knowledge, and here's the thing about it, too. I don't think that any of those teams that you just mentioned that were not the Carolina Hurricanes were anything more than picking up the phone, calling, and checking in.
Oh, I
agree. And it ended right there. First of all, I'll say this, too. I don't think it was going to work for any other team.
I don't think he was going to play anywhere else.
And I'm not saying in terms of playing anywhere else. I don't think this situation was going to work for any other team in the sense that I think he's been around Carolina the entire offseason. He's been working out the whole time, and I think if you presented him with an offer, and this is any team, if it was the Flyers, if it was Boston, if it was any of those teams that were mentioned, for him to have to at that stage of the year, you're past the halfway point of the year, it's mid-January at this point, uproot your life from where you've been living, which he's been living in Carolina.
Right.
Uproot your life, go to play somewhere else, get acclimated to another team that you may not know any of the guys really there. I mean, with Justin Williams on the Flyers, you can't even say
there's
that about
no
a
connection.
Long time. Right, you can't even say that about a guy like Claude Giroux because even that was, you know, even Williams was before his time.
Right. No, I agree.
You know, so you
Carolina had him at hello.
Yeah, and not only that, but to bring him into that room at this time, You know, I mean, the situation is obviously the situation is similar to Mike Fisher with Nashville a few years back, and the object is that he's not jumping in to be a captain anymore. He's here to be. I mean, he'll be there to be a leader, but
he's
not jumping
to be
Mr.
Game
7. Kind of, but
let's be real. He signed to a playoff contract.
But in general, I mean, here's the thing about it too. They're already a deep team as it is, and he's going to make them deeper. It's going to be, you know, I think this is going to be a real seamless transition for them because of the fact that there are so many guys from a year ago who know him well and who he doesn't have to acclimate himself to a lot of new faces. I can tell you that much. It's going to be pretty seamless for him to jump in and be part of that team. And I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I think when Fisher signed with Nashville again and came out of retirement to play a few years back, it took him about a month to a month and a half to get back into game shape and feel ready to go. Like, I think he signed somewhere in January and didn't play until right around the trade deadline.
I think he played right before the trade deadline because he had to get in to be playoff eligible.
Right. And I think Justin Williams is back with Carolina. I think he's in that lineup as soon as the All-Star breaks over.
I agree. And
probably about 2.5 weeks away. I can see that.
Yeah, and I totally agree that I think he was always going to end up in Carolina. But I was actually listening to 31 Thoughts, the podcast, with Elliot Friedman and Jeff Merrick. Mm-hmm. It's a really good insider podcast. If any of our listeners want to check it out, I highly recommend it. And Friedman, who's just the godfather of being an insider, he's absolutely insane, the things he knows when he knows it. But he talked about the fact that apparently it was a tough negotiation with Williams in Carolina. And you think it's a, you know, almost a league min contract, a two-way deal with AHL time and blah, 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 with the guy who was just your captain 8 months ago. It seems like it should be super easy. But apparently they were, that negotiation was pretty tooth and nail. So I didn't know. Williams might have looked at other options. He might have taken, you know, taken the phone call from Boston, taken the phone call from Toronto, even knowing that his options are probably sign with Carolina or stay retired. But either way, he ended up in Carolina, and this team that we're fighting with for playoff position just got better, and that's less than
better.
Ideal.
Yeah, marginally better. Let's not, you know, huge clutch game seven guy, but he's 4 years removed from that stuff. So
I think given how young Carolina is.
No, it makes sense for Carolina. Yeah, there's no loss.
I think it's a bigger off-ice risk to it.
Yeah,
right.
It's
a bigger off-ice addition than on-ice, in my opinion.
It's a good move for Carolina. But let's not say, okay, now they're going to be the third seed and got a good shot to win the cup because they got Justin Williams. It's not that.
Well, no.
No, if anything about signing Justin Williams makes them better, it's going to be the fact that his added depth is probably going to open up even more opportunities for the guys who are the game changers on that team. Yep. For Svechnikov, for Aho, for Niederreiter, for Stahl is still good, Teravainen. Those are the guys who drive that team. Williams is going to be a secondary figure, but he's good enough as a secondary figure that teams are going to have to keep him honest. And it creates more of an off-balance situation for opposing defenses to have to play against them. That's where they get better.
But I'm telling you right now, he's going to score a huge goal in the playoffs because he always does. A game winner, an overtime goal, a series winner.
I wouldn't say it's
years removed from that.
He's going to score a ridiculous goal. You heard it here first. He's going to score winner or a series winner at some point.
I think the much larger upside for Justin Williams and a lot of the reason why they brought him in is Kevin just mentioned all those young guys that he could help maybe possibly free up. I think it's also to show those guys, here's what you got to do at the big moments.
Exactly.
Here's how you have to play. Here's how you have to attack it. And it's a show me the way, even though you maybe can't do it anymore, you know, leader type of thing.
Exactly.
To show the way to the promised land, more so than delivering the promised land.
I mentioned that it's a bigger off-ice addition than on-ice addition, and that's exactly what I meant. I think so too.
Yeah, and I think so too, because of the fact that, you know, Carolina is not one of those top three teams in the Metro that you think of right off the top of your head like that. I think that there were thoughts that that they could be and should be with the talent that they have, that they're such a good young team.
And they still can be. Yeah.
And exactly.
They just need to figure out a way to get saves. That's all they need.
Well, their goaltending is suspect, but I also think
Flyers legend Peter Mrazek is starting a lot of games for them.
Well, in fairness too, look at the way the Flyers scored their first two goals of that game and took a 2-0 lead on them at the start. That was some sloppy hockey by a team that's on paper should be
sloppy.
Way better, you know, especially given the situation that the Flyers are in with all the injuries they have currently. I mean, they were playing that game without Justin Braun on the defensive side, which it may not make a huge difference from some performance levels, but as a minutes eater and the way that he provides balance, I think that it does make a little bit of a difference. Playing without Lindblom is obviously something we've talked about multiple times
right.
from a forward depth standpoint. Your fourth line in that game was what? I think Vorobyev, Lawton, and Farabee or something like that.
And it wasn't great. Which,
and that wasn't great at all.
Mark Friedman played in Saturday night's game because Ghost is out for 3 weeks. The depth of this team has taken a real hit.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. In fairness, I think Mark Friedman's been fine in these first two
games.
He's been pretty good.
Totally.
And I've liked that pairing, believe it or not. You know, and it's crazy to say I've liked Robert Haig's pairing in two games because we've had a lot to say about him sometimes. But I've liked that pairing in the two games because they've actually limited their time the way that they need to be limited. They've played him in the right situations, and it works out.
Yeah.
You know, both of them have been doing on the defensive end. I've noticed in both of these games, they haven't panicked to throw the puck away and just throw it up the boards. There were at least three or four times last night, Haig especially, where he was kind of double-teamed in the corner. And he had puck, and he just left it there. Eventually, a flyer came over to help. He had possession. He didn't just whack it up the boards. Okay, now the defenseman has it. Shot on goal. He just left it in the corner
and waited for help.
You can take the puck from me. Let's see if you can take it from me. But I'm not just giving it away. So hopefully, he's making some strides there.
Yeah, and I also thought their fourth line was better with Lawton at center than it was with Vorobyev. I mean, Vorobyev just is one of those players.
Vorobyev's not an NHL player.
Exactly. It's not translating. And it's funny because
I like him, but he's just not.
Well, here's the thing. It's funny. There are guys on the team right now who, at the minor league level, maybe didn't produce at that crazy rate that you like to see before you call a guy up. You think about when Lindblom got called up at the very, last or 2 years ago, and it was, look at the number of goals he's scoring in the minors. You don't have much of a choice anymore. You've got to get him
up to
the next level.
He's
better than that league is. You've got to get him to the next level. And, to an extent, while Farabee's not having that kind of production at the NHL level, he went down at the start of the year
and had 4 points in
four
games.
No experience, goes 3 goals right away.
Yep.
And you see how his skill level translates to that league. And I think that there's guys on this team that have the same that don't have that kind of success in the minors that still look like they can fit the part. Nicolas Aubé-Kubel is one that comes to mind. You know, he's a guy, and he's not light enough to score sheet by any stretch, but he's not looking out of place and playing in fairly significant minutes.
Yeah, I've been less impressed with his game so far.
No, but you pointed out something, and I'll mention where you're not as impressed with him. I think, and
okay.
I think there's a reason why. At 5-on-5, I think he does just fine.
Okay.
He's a good energy player, and I don't know that I love him. Like, I don't know that I'm fully satisfied with the line combinations completely, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that a lot of that's been taken out of Alain Vigneault's hands with injuries and the Oscar situation, et cetera.
A lot of it has, and here's what I'll say also. There are guys on each, the third line and the fourth line, if you want to go there, because Alain Vigneault doesn't even like to go there. He doesn't classify them 1 through 4. We all do because that's how we roll with this.
That's
stuff.
How the human brain organizes
right.
things.
We know structure. We know 1, 2, 3, 4. What do you know? We
Who plays the most? That. They're the first line.
Correct. So I look at the six guys that make up the bottom six. And I can rearrange them in so many different ways.
There's a lot of combinations there.
I don't know that I love calling Scott Lawton a fourth line center when I think he's probably better suited as a third line center. If you're calling Michael Raffel a center,
for the record, I love Raffel and Pitlick together.
And that's the thing. I like Raffel and Pitlick together too. I think Pitlick's energy, given the way your depth has been hit, makes him look more like a third line player than a fourth line player. I'm not saying that he produces at that rate or anything like that, but I think he looks more like a third line guy than a fourth line guy.
Yeah.
In this depth situation with a fully optimal lineup, you would put him on the fourth line, no question.
In a perfect world, he's a really, really, really good fourth liner. Yeah, I agree.
But here's the other thing about it. I don't understand why Joel Farabee's playing on the fourth line.
Yeah.
I don't get that at all.
And I don't understand why Nick Aubé-Kubel is on the power play, which I think is what you were alluding to earlier.
Well, yes. Well, and here's the thing. You can question a lot of things with the power play right now. It was a very – let's just wait. All you had to do, if anybody saw Jake Voracek's media availability last night, you know what a sore topic it was.
I didn't see that, actually. But, like,
he was one of the last ones to talk, so it might have been past –
Oh, I didn't watch any of the post-game – media availability, but for the love of God, can we just put Claude Giroux back in the one-timer spot? I'm so sick of him being on the right wall. I get why they do it. I get why you want to have him open to the zone and able to make any pass that he sees, but
well, I'll say this,
it
though.
Frustrates me.
In the game against Tampa Bay, he was actually there more than not.
Good.
You know, he was there more than not, and Tampa Bay is a really good team on all fronts. You know, and they've been playing incredibly well, so you have to give them props for knowing how to defend the situation. That being said, I don't disagree with a whole lot of what Alain Vigneault says. Usually he's been saying the right things or pushing the right
buttons
lately.
He's been really, really good, yeah.
I didn't know where he was coming from with his comments about the power play, because he said something about how he thinks it's been good. He mentioned that they scored in four straight games. My thought instantly went to, which four straight are we talking?
Right. Well, because, wasn't that like 3 weeks ago?
Well, not just that. It's this. The four games as I calculate them, because I went back and I started looking at box scores, and I'm going, which four in a row does he think
is he talking about? Right.
Because I don't even know if I remembered a streak of four in a row where they scored a power play goal.
I think I do.
Here's where the four games were, and it's a little bit of a, like, it's a little bit of a misconstrued four games.
Oh, wait, was it Anaheim, Buffalo, Ottawa, New York right before the Christmas break?
It's not exactly that. They did not score on the power play against Anaheim.
Okay. Oh, so it's Buffalo, Ottawa, New York, and then San Jose?
The Buffalo game is a great example of a power play being successful at that time.
Sure.
That was a questionable goal in terms of a team challenged it. You got a power play as a result, and you had a shot at 2-0 to bury a team without their star player, and you did.
Yep.
And then you scored another
power
play goal.
They did go on to score two more power play goals in that game. Yeah.
Right. The rest of them, though, to me, were very questionable to rule as success as much. There was a power play goal against Ottawa that opened the scoring by Kevin Hayes. It was a partial breakaway where he fooled the goalie into thinking he was going one way, drifted the puck in. It's not really a straight setup.
It's not a power play.
It was a lead pass that happened to work out.
Right.
That's not your standard typical power play goal. The power play goal against the Rangers the next game was a garbage time power play goal by Aubé Kubel. That's not the same thing. That's not a game change. Like, it doesn't change the result of that game. Then the San Jose game was the fourth one. That was the power play goal by Provorov, the only one the Flyers scored in the game. It turned it from 3-0 to 3-1, and what effect did that really have on the game when the opposing team scores a minute later and makes it 4-1, and everybody could, if they were still awake at that time, could just go to bed.
Right.
You know, it was that. Other than that, you know, I looked at it. I tried to look for any other spot where the Flyers have scored a power play goal, and I'm going, they scored a power play goal against LA also in garbage time when you're losing 5-1. That doesn't really do it for me. I don't remember them. I don't think they scored a power play goal in any of the games really since then. Maybe the one in Vegas. But one in Vegas to make it 5-4, then you had almost 2 minutes of 6-on-3 time and couldn't score.
Couldn't put the puck away, yeah.
And then from there, they've just not been... I think that was the last time... That might be the last time they scored a power play goal, quite honestly.
But you know what? If I know anything about the Flyers and Bruins, I think the Flyers are going to have more chances at working a power play this week. Boston knows how to throw the body around. St. Louis knows how to throw the body around. Montreal and LA know how to muck and grind too. The Flyers might get a lot of power play chances this week. And we might see a turnaround from the power play unit, and we'll see how that goes. Let us know how you think the power play is going to do. Maybe we'll have Mike put a poll up and see how many power play goals the Flyers score this week in four games. You can find that poll on Twitter at YWTPodcast. You can follow producer Mike at Mike_Giletto or Mike Sr. here at Mike from S Jersey. Kevin's everywhere. He's at Kevin_Durso, at Sports Talk PHL during games. He's with 97.3 ESPN. He's with Sports Talk Philly. Anything we didn't need to know, Kev? Write any good articles this week?
I had mentioned briefly the thing about perspective on the road trip. That was I didn't do many observation pieces after, like, post game for a lot of the holidays. We did the show, the big holiday show, I think it was on the day after the Ottawa game. So I didn't write anything that morning. Didn't write anything after the Ranger game, given that it was Christmas Eve by that point, so kind of took some time. And then all those late games on the road trip mixed with holiday stuff. LA was on New Year's Eve. You jumped right from watching that to, hey, it's almost midnight, you know?
Yep.
So stuff like that. So I finally rounded all those thoughts up and then got back to doing the regular after the fact. And that's really all I've got so far, but I did try to pin up the fact that perspective on that road trip. It was only six games, but a lot of things need to get better, and the power play is especially one of them. I mean, there were enough... like I said, I disagree with what Alain Vigneault said about it. I did not disagree with what Sean Couturier had to say about it in terms of... Sean Couturier mentioned not only it's not scoring, but he also classified it as too many one-and-done chances, and I agree with that completely.
Yes.
Jake Voracek didn't offer as much insight. He just said they're not scoring, they've got to start scoring, and didn't want to talk about it after that. And it was, to be honest with you, it was as short as I've heard any player this year.
Yeah, there was definitely...
In terms of frustration level.
Definitely some frustration.
And there is the thought that... because. Jake was playing a little bit at net front on power play at times over the course of maybe parts of the road trip, or I don't remember seeing it at any of the home games, and maybe that's just because for the most part the puck didn't really get there anyway, so I wasn't looking at who was playing net front as much as it was same guys on the perimeter, follow the puck, go another clear, okay,
yep.
You know, line change anyway, you know, stuff like that. But there's the thought that AV said that he from his like memory, Jake's one of the better net front guys and has had success there before. That's never been where he's played on the power play in years past, and it's not to say, you know, at one point in time, Jake turned around and said the power play's been the same for, like, the last 10 years or whatever it is, and that's not true either.
Right.
But it's not, you know, but he's not, I don't remember him playing net front at any point, and that's one thing I can remember being kind of unchanging. Maybe he switched wings a couple times, and he's not in that one-timer spot from his side, or Drew's in the one-timer spot from the left side. But he's never been, as from my knowledge, he's never been net front. It's never been his thing. And I don't know that that's going to be success. And there was belief that that might be his way of, without specifically saying, I don't like that role, saying I don't like that role. And that's like without throwing anybody by name under the bus or saying I don't like this. He kind of hinted
expressed
at, like,
some displeasure.
In the sense that I don't want to talk about it was his way of deflecting. So
right.
Well, Kevin, do you feel he feels like he's being phased out to some extent?
I don't know about that. I mean, because I don't think he's complaining about it playing in the same spot that he's used to if he's on the first or second unit. I kind of liked splitting up Giroux and Voracek a little bit, you know, because I do think Konechny's elevated his game to be part of the first unit.
Yeah,
for
he
sure.
has to be. Yeah.
Provorov's leading your team among defensemen in goals on the power play.
He's leading the league, isn't he?
He might be still. I don't know if he is still. I know he was at the top at one point because he hasn't. The team's lack of scoring a power play goal in general has possibly cost him there. But to go back to the structure, I think the second unit needs some work, and I understand that it's hard to do when your depth is taking a hit like it is. You know, the top unit's always going to have, and I agree with AV in this sense, where the consistency of that top unit is Giroux, Couturier, Konechny, Provorov, and kind of a rotating guy. And you can make the choice. You can put Voracek out there, or you can put JVR out there and try to make that guy. You know, I would put JVR on the top unit if you're going to put Voracek at net front.
Right, I'd rather have JVR at net front.
Guy,
his hands are good.
Put the guy who's known for it.
Right, that's what he does.
He's not being the goal scorer that people want him to be, and I understand that, but he's your best option. You've got to go with it, you know.
Right. It's fine. Just bring Wayne Simmons back.
That I wouldn't go that far though either because
I'm joking.
I heard a little bit of that discussion from last week too, and that's just, you know, I don't see Chuck Fletcher making a move to make a move. He's going to make one that has benefits that go, I would think, that have potential to go beyond this year. It's not strictly a rental guy. And he's not going to be the guy who trades a young guy to try to make the team better
now.
Effective immediately.
Not unless it has long-term
Right, with long-term
considerations as well. And they do desperately need a top six forward.
When do we trade for Johnny Gaudreau? He's got 2 years left on his contract. They're not real happy with how things are going. There's talk about breaking up their core, and Johnny's a good guy to go.
If you're looking for blockbuster, I think you can forget the rest of the season and you can focus on the off season.
That's fair, and we'll see how that goes. But regardless, we'll see what the Flyers do. I think that's going to do it for today's show. Tweet us your ideas of what the Flyers need to do to get better on the power play at YWT Podcast. Again, Mike is Mike from S Jersey, Mike Giletto, or producer Mike is at Mike_Giletto. Kevin's at Kevin_Durso. Let everybody know what you think. I'm really curious to see what our fans have to say about 6 weeks out from the deadline. Do the Flyers make a move? Do the Flyers do nothing? What kind of piece do they add? And we'll figure that out. This week, we got a couple of big games, and next week, we'll have a Penguins game to preview. So until then, we'll see you guys next week.